Post Sandy lessons from China and Japan. Today, Monday, October 28th, this is The World. I'm Aaron Schachter, in for Marco Werman. A year ago, Superstorm Sandy devastated New York's Rockaways community. A young woman who lived there tells us what she learned after Sandy from earthquake and tsunami zones on the other side of the globe.
It really became clear to me that we're entering a new era where natural disasters are going to become somewhat common.
Also, dueling images of America in Iran, including one place that hasn't changed since the hostage crisis.
The American embassy lies like a sort of rotten tooth in the center of Tehran.
Plus, a Yemeni-American girl takes some flack for breaking with tradition and going to college.
I kind of tip my hat to my mom, who is really good at shutting those comments down.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association in their effort to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by diabetes. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com. And by ITVS with Independent Lens, exploring the issues in education today through the eyes of six Latino and Latina students from across the United States. The Graduates, tonight at 10, 9 Central, only on PBS.
I'm Aaron Schachter, in for Marco Werman. This is The World. They're cleaning up in southern England right now after a major storm lashed the region with hurricane-force winds and heavy rains. Authorities have blamed the storm for a number of deaths. Britain's pain today comes almost a year after Superstorm Sandy left a tragic mark on New York and New Jersey. Life just hasn't been the same since for many in that area. Among them, Jen Poyant. She's a senior producer with our sister PRI program, The Takeaway. Last October 29th, she was at work in Manhattan when the storm devastated the neighborhood where she lived, the Rockaways in Queens. She still remembers her shock when she finally made it home after the storm.
It really did look like a war zone. It was difficult coming back from Manhattan after the storm because it had just been inundated with debris and sand and soot to the point where people were walking around for days just listless, trying to figure out where to begin. And then there are many that have managed to get home, like me. I was only away for about a month and a half, and I was able to get back into my home and get moving again very quickly. Mm. I was lucky.
Aside from you getting back into your home, there was another positive outcome from this experience. You went on a fellowship with a place called the East-West Center, based in Honolulu, and it's a fellowship on natural disasters.
Yes, so as a way to process my own experience watching my own community go through this, I decided very quickly to apply for this fellowship that studies disaster management around the world. So it compared Hurricane Sandy and the response and recovery process that's really just beginning in New York to the Sendai region in Japan, where the great earthquake happened in 2011, and then also to the great Sichuan earthquake that killed so many people back in 2008.
Now, in all these places, the New York metropolitan area, China, and Japan, people had to rely a great deal on government help. How did that play out in those different places?
I think in New York, the expectation is very high. It's get me the money now to rebuild my home. I can't believe it's been a year, and I can't wade through this bureaucratic process. I think historically, the Japanese culture has been the high level of trust with the government, and only over the past 2.5 years of watching mistake after mistake with the handling of both Fukushima as well as the immediate aftermath of the tsunami have residents and voters managed to start speaking out about their frustrations and what they need. But there is a measured expression of frustration with the Japanese government, I think, for the first time. I've really had not witnessed that before in my time in Japan in the past. And then, of course, in China, you know, you don't really talk about the government and what the expectation is. You just take what you can get.
And China and Japan are a little further out from their earthquake tragedies. How do things look there?
You know, I was mostly struck in China by the incredible pace of development. I was in Chengdu, and then we traveled out to some smaller towns out in the mountains in the Sichuan province. And they do manage to keep some buildings. Like, I went to a middle school where children had died and, You know, there were many reports after the great earthquake in Sichuan about how the building codes there had been lax enough to create these so-called tofu buildings that didn't have the right support structures within their concrete. So they managed to keep some of those destroyed buildings as a monument to the people that died and as a reminder. I'd say Japan, the debris is gone, but the buildings are still gone as well in many cases. And you can tell there's still a lot of scars to deal with in recovery on the Japanese landscape.
Now, Jen, your trip to China and Japan was obviously a professional one. You're a journalist. But what did you learn? What did you bring back to the situation in Rockaway where you live?
I have to say, going to Japan and China after experiencing and living and watching my own neighborhood go through a natural disaster, it really became clear to me that we're entering a new era where natural disasters are going to become somewhat common. And I think this fellowship really comes down to understanding how human beings work together in these events and whether or not there's a way to organize it better each time.
Jen Poyant is a senior producer at our partner program, The Takeaway, with PRI. Jen, thank you for your time.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Superstorm Sandy sounded a blaring alarm bell about the growing threats from climate change. In the days and months after the disaster, politicians from New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg to President Obama issued new warnings and announced new steps to address the threat. But a year later, U.S. climate policy remains largely where it was before, stalled by Washington gridlock. And that's meant that big climate policy battles are being fought in some unexpected places. Here's our story from reporter Ashley Ahern of the journalism collaborative EarthFix and station KUOW in Seattle.
Not long ago, the big dramas over fighting global climate change played out in places like Copenhagen and Washington, D.C. Today, they're playing out in places like this neighborhood in Bellingham, Washington, up the coast from Seattle.
Hi, I'm Isabel Vanderslice with the Whatcom Conservation Voters.
We're the campaign supporting the four county council candidates who are opposed to coal. Are you familiar with the coal port issue?
Yeah.
This voter has not publicly declared her position on the coal port issue yet.
Are you opposed to it?
Well,
it's
kind of half and half, though, yeah.
But you'll see a lot of yard signs elsewhere around Whatcom County. Some say no coal trains. Others say stop the war on workers. Just about everyone around here knows the big issue at stake in this fall's county commission race, a proposed shipping terminal that would send coal from Wyoming and Montana onto ships bound for Asia. It would be the largest coal export facility on the West Coast and a lifeline for a sagging U.S. coal industry. And it's become a big target for environmentalists because coal is one of the biggest contributors to climate change.
We're very committed to fighting and winning anytime the issue of climate change is on the ballot.
Brendan Chehovic is the head of Washington Conservation Voters.
There's a lot of eyes across the country and around the world watching what's happening this fall in Whatcom County.
And there's a lot of money flowing into the election. In the past, county council candidates spent maybe $20,000 each to get elected. But this year, Washington Conservation Voters has so far spent almost $250,000. The lion's share of that money has come from one man, California billionaire and environmentalist Tom Steyer. And until recently, it had helped coal opponents outspend supporters by more than 3-1. But the environmentalists are losing their lead in the election spending arms race. Pro-coal forces have formed a new PAC called Save Whatcom, and most of its funding is coming from large companies who want to see the terminal built. But the PAC's chair, Chris Halterman, says the election isn't about coal.
Our focus is on jobs and business growth. We don't care about anything else. We care about jobs and business growth and protecting the industry because it's under threat right now.
But no matter how you frame the debate, the unprecedented amount of money flowing into this election, now approaching $1 million, suggests it's become a proxy for the largely stalemated climate policy debate on the national level. Ross McFarlane is a senior advisor with the environmental nonprofit Climate Solutions.
Without having any kind of a national policy around energy, any kind of a national policy around climate, you're seeing a lot more attention being focused on local and state decisions, which end up being very significant in terms of what our future energy and climate policy is going to be.
Mail-in voting for the Whatcom County race is already underway and will continue until November 5th. Anti-coal activists say they need to pick up 2 seats to get a majority on the council. But whoever wins, it could be more than 2 years before the council actually votes on the coal terminal project. For The World, I'm Ashley Ahern, Bellingham, Washington.
Drivers in Iran's capital, Tehran, were treated to a billboard ad campaign last week called American Honesty. The billboards posted in many busy intersections offered a less than flattering image of the U.S. as a negotiating partner. The Iranian government says the ads went up without their knowledge or consent. And this weekend, the posters came down. It's all part of the long-running battle between hardliners and reformers in Iran. So says New York Times Tehran bureau chief Thomas Erdbrink. I asked him to describe some of the billboards he saw.
They show two men sitting across each other on a round table, and one is clearly Iranian, and he has an Iranian flag next to him. The other one is clearly American, has an American flag next to him. But where the Iranian is dressed very formal, the American is actually wearing combat trousers. The same poster in another variation is of the American negotiator with an attack dog. Another one is a poster of a hand reaching out, which is being met by a very scary, almost Halloween-like claw. And this also is a famous saying from Iran's supreme leader, who says that the Americans, they have an iron fist covered up with a velvet glove.
Right.
It all means that they don't trust the Americans in the negotiations.
Right. It's about the duplicitousness of American officials.
Exactly.
These billboards that you described have come down, and as we said, that seems like good news. But I guess the hardline faction is planning a grand day of death to America sometime next month, early next month. What's up with that?
Well, every year here on November 4th, the Iranians commemorate that Islamic students in the first year of the revolution, 1979, took over the U.S. embassy building. The event was recently captured in the movie Argo. Well, every year this is remembered by Iranians. A lot of them actually school children who are bussed in and who go in front of the embassy and shout, "Death to America," in order to show their allegiance to the revolution and to the ideals of the revolution, as they call it.
Thomas, what does the American embassy look like these days there in Tehran?
Well, the American embassy lies like a sort of rotten tooth in the center of Tehran. It's a very big garden where, unlike the rest of the city, nothing has changed over the last 34 years. When you walk past it, you see a relatively low wall with murals on them of Lady Liberty with a skull and variations on this theme. And when you peek over the walls, you see this huge embassy. You can see the garden. You can see some of the residents. This is where the diplomats used to live. Only now it is no longer called the U.S. Embassy, but the Great Den of Espionage, and it is a base for an Iranian paramilitary organization.
Thomas, why not pull that tooth, so to speak? Why not raise the embassy and put up something else there?
Well, if you're optimistic, you would say that there are some in Iran who think that at some point this building could be put to its old use again, and this could be a new American embassy, even though we all know that U.S. embassies nowadays across the world are big fortresses outside of the city centers. But those who are more pessimistic would say that, at least from an American point of view, would say that the Iranians are keeping the embassy building alive as a kind of testament to their own achievements in the revolution. Every day, again, the people driving past this embassy, walking past this embassy, are remembered by the fact that there are no relations between Iran and the world's only superpower. And that is something that a lot of Iranian leaders are very happy about.
Now, Thomas, a lot of what we talk about, including this battle of the billboards, is different political factions kind of having at each other. What do regular Iranians make of this battle between the hardliners and the less hardliners, I guess?
You just need to go to the airport in Tehran and to see how many Iranians are actually arriving from the United States, visiting their family members here and traveling to the United States from Iran, to understand that for normal people, relations have never stopped.
Thomas Erdbrink, the Tehran bureau chief of the New York Times, thank you as always for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, a Saudi comedian gets a lot of attention for a video he's done mixing Bob Marley and women drivers. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from ITVS with Independent Lens, exploring the issues in education today through the eyes of 6 Latino and Latina students from across the United States. The graduates, tonight at 10, 9 Central, only on PBS. And from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association. November is Diabetes Awareness Month. You can test your risk for diabetes at stopdiabetesnow.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter, and this is The World.
For some immigrant families, it's not unusual to want to stick to traditions from back home, but it's also not unusual for newer generations to find those norms too strict. As part of our Global Nation coverage, reporter Hannah Baba has the story of one young woman whose family comes from Yemen. She's trying to break cultural barriers without breaking cultural ties.
Sumaya Al-Baggal is from California. She studies here, and her parents are from Yemen. In some ways, she's had a pretty typical American life, except for some family traditions.
I was 18 when I went to Yemen and got married. I think I chose it because it was a natural trajectory of the expectation my family set for me, and then also what I understood my position was as a Yemeni woman. Was, you know, you get married and that's kind of where life begins.
Al-Baggal is 27 now. She accepted going to Yemen for an arranged marriage as a cultural tradition, but she resists other traditions. In the San Francisco Bay Area, a recent survey found it's still extremely rare to see a Yemeni woman earning a college degree. Conservative norms can hold them back.
And perhaps I think that was comfortable for my family because, you know, you have this dual track for life. On the one hand, it's abiding by the Yemeni expectation of getting married and having children and building that. And on the other hand, it was kind of this off the road, ambitious, like, you know, go to college and see what happens there. And my family went there with me.
After community college, Al-Baggal headed to Berkeley, and now she's at law school. But she still doesn't know many other Yemeni women in college here. Part of it is that the Yemeni community is still small in the Bay Area, numbering about 5,000, not like bigger, more established presences in, say, Michigan. But Al-Baggal is hoping to speed things up. She recently became the first female officer with the local chapter of ASIP, or the American Association of Yemeni Scientists and Professionals. It's a national group started by Yemeni Americans tired of their community being known as one of poorly educated shopkeepers and illiterate women. So Al-Baggal visits families at home and hosts women-only workshops to spread the word about education opportunities in the area. But it's a challenge.
Getting the Yemeni female community to attend these workshops and to take this step has been really, really difficult.
Al-Baggal knows the cultural barriers well, that Yemeni women, especially new moms, can be expected to stay at home.
You know, kind of the sly comments of, oh, what is that like? And what time does she ever get home to take care of her family? And who makes dinner, you know, things like that.
And then Al-Baggal had a chance to see just how far a Yemeni woman can go. Recently, she helped host a talk at Berkeley by the activist Tawakkul Karman. She shared the Nobel Peace Prize in 2011 for pushing for democracy in Yemen. With her arm in the air, Karman chanted a revolutionary Arabic poem, the one she used to rouse the streets of Yemen. At Berkeley, the crowd was mostly men, with a few women turning out. Even so, Karman stressed education for women.
For Yemeni women, don't disappear, and you will not be able to change your future without learning. You have to be in the school and also in the college, and I am sure that you are so smart, so clever, and you will achieve all your goals.
Sumaya Al-Baggal says it helps for the community to see women like Karman speak up, but she knows change comes slowly. Like her own family, the cultural norm to marry first, then maybe get educated, remains strong. But last spring, the local ASIP chapter threw a high school graduation party, and it left Al-Baggal pretty hopeful.
We had like 300 people attend, and we were just amazed. The audience was moved by these women in their graduation robes and just how proud they were of their daughters and of these Yemeni women who still looked like Yemeni women but were achieving these great levels of success. They would like it to be kind of like a harmony of like, let's move towards change together. Let's all agree that this is good for us.
And she says she's willing to move at whatever pace it takes to get there. For The World, I'm Hanat Baba in Berkeley.
Hannah's story was made possible by New America Media's Women Immigrants Fellowship. And you can join our ongoing Global Nation conversation online. Tweet us at PRI Global Nation. Let's hear now from another woman who's breaking cultural barriers in California. Her name is Yuna, and she's a pop singer from Malaysia. She's a law school grad who moved to Los Angeles to further her musical career, and that's where she recorded her new album, which comes out tomorrow. It's called Nocturnal. Here she is in her own words.
Hi, I'm Yuna, and I'm a singer-songwriter, and this song is called I Want You Back. I started writing when I was really young, like poetry. Like, I started out writing poetry when I was like 14, 15, but back then, you know, like I never really like looked into songwriting, you know, like I always wondered like, oh, how do all these people, you know, how do they write music? How do they write songs? To me, like, it seemed impossible for me to do something like that.
I'm still up, it's 4 a.m., I don't know what to make of today.
I grew up speaking Malay first, and then, you know, like, I learned how to speak English from listening to English music. Writing in English, it's much more simpler, you know, like, the words are more simpler, and the Malay language is so complex. It's really beautiful, and you have to know how to write it when you try to sing it in a direct way, like how you were to have a conversation with someone. It wouldn't sound, you know, beautiful.
Feeling like I did something wrong.
Back home in Malaysia, you know, like there's a lot of expectations from people. For the past 7 years, you know, I was, you know, under a microscope. People just look on the surface of, like, the life of someone famous. You know, they don't, sometimes they forget that, you know, that person is still a person, is still a real person with feelings. And they turn off the lights and then they cry, you know, just like everyone else. So sometimes they forget about that.
I keep writing all these words in my head so I know what to say.
My dad is a legal advisor, and I grew up, you know, just watching him going to trials and stuff like that. He used to be a judge, like a session court's judge. I grew up with my cousin trying to be a lawyer. She went to law school, and then kind of, you know, like just like, okay, I'm going to be a lawyer, you know. It seemed like a pretty good idea back then, but after I graduated, you know, I was already into music, you know, I was already doing so well in the music industry in Malaysia. I decided to just keep on doing what I was doing, and eventually, like, it brought me here.
It's giving you a heart attack. Hate myself for doing that. You're the best thing I ever.
Malaysian
know.
Singer Yuna.
Oh. Close my eyes and hold my breath. Hoping that we pass this test, trying to believe that it's
You're listening to The World from PRI. I'm Aaron Schachter. Ahead, teasing out Indian influences in Silicon Valley, including the origin of the word avatar.
Avatar is actually a Sanskrit Hindi word. It's a spirit taking a new form for something. For me, every time I see that word, it instills a sense of pride.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association in their effort to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by diabetes. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com. And by ITVS with Independent Lens, exploring the issues in education today through the eyes of 6 Latino and Latina students from across the United States. The Graduates, tonight at 10, 9 Central, only on PBS.
I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. The revelations about the NSA just keep on coming. Major U.S. allies have been learning, one after the other, that the U.S. has been spying on its leaders and its citizens. The latest to demand an explanation is Spain. Yet even with allied noses out of joint, American diplomats have to keep up their work. Syria and Iran, and so many other international issues to be discussed. So how are the leaks by Edward Snowden compromising U.S. diplomacy? Stephen Walt is a professor of international affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Stephen, everyone seems to be publicly shocked by these revelations. Are they really a big deal, do you think?
Well, I don't know how big a deal they are, but they're not trivial. And they're not trivial because even though most governments are aware that spying goes on, they're spying on us and we're spying on them, it does create a domestic political problem when you see both how extensive and how intrusive the NSA's surveillance program has been. And the problem there is that for governments in Spain or Brazil or Germany, it now becomes politically costly to be seen as too intimately or too closely cooperating with the United States, at least right now. So you have leaders who have to, at a minimum, protest. They have to call in the ambassadors, and give them a dressing down. But to some extent, I think for the next few months, these are going to be governments that aren't going to want to be supporting the United States too visibly, because that's going to be seen as costly in terms of their own domestic public opinion.
Now, you have a good word there. You say they don't want to be seen visibly supporting the United States. But I've seen a few quotes from around the world. The French foreign minister, Bernard Kouchner, says, let's face it, we eavesdrop too. We're just jealous of the United States. The British ambassador in Lebanon, Tom Fletcher, tweeted, I work on the assumption that more than six countries are tapping my phone. I get that they have to protest visibly, but if everybody's doing it, what's the big deal?
Partly it's because the extent of American activity, if all of these governments understood that there was a certain amount of spying going on and people trying to compromise diplomats or get people to say things perhaps indiscreetly, that's one thing. But then to learn that the United States was actually able to, say, tap the cell phone of the German chancellor and listen to private conversations and, moreover, have been doing that for years. Not only does that remind everyone about what kinds of capabilities the United States has, but it starts to make the United States look a little bit like it's out of control. And the question Americans should be asking is, even if we may have gotten some useful information out of some of these operations, was that really worth the cost it was going to impose in terms of a certain degree of diplomatic cooperation and the reputation of the United States more broadly in these societies? I think that's what American diplomats are now worried about.
So how do you think the situation goes when U.S. officials are talking with France, Mexico, or Spain right now?
Well, I think people are going to be a little bit more careful. And also, diplomats from other countries are going to try to use this to extract some concessions from us. You know, we would like to help you, Uncle Sam, but, you're not very popular in my country right now, and I'm really not going to be able to give you what you want. You're going to have to give me a little bit more of what I want, so that I can then sell that as a good deal to my own population. It's also worth noting here that the United States previously had been very visible about pushing for internet freedom for quite some time, and we'd been very critical of governments that tried to put limits on the internet, countries like China. We now look quite hypocritical in that position, because other populations will say, oh, well, we know why the United States likes internet freedom.
Right, so they can spy on us.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's going to make it more difficult for us, too.
So how does a country bounce back from something like this? And I wonder if there are any similar scandals, if you will, anywhere else.
Well, the same way I think that in our personal lives we bounce back when we've made a mistake or offended someone. You say you're sorry, and you don't necessarily prostrate yourself with guilt, but you express regret and say you'll work these differences out and you won't do it again in the future. And I think what we will see happening with at least some of our allies is an attempt to work out, let's call it a code of conduct. It may be even a sort of gentleman's agreement about what's going to be done and what's not going to be done. The only challenge there is if we reach such an agreement, which acknowledges there's going to be some amount of spying, maybe declares other activities off limits, then we really have to abide by it. Because if we reach another agreement and then are caught, 5 years from now, exceeding it, that's going to cause even more trouble.
Stephen Walt, Professor of International Affairs at Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Pleasure as always to speak with you.
Nice talking with you too.
Diwali, the Hindu Festival of Lights, is coming up soon. You knew that. But they've been getting a head start on the celebrations in California's Silicon Valley. That's home, of course, to tech companies large and small, and thousands who work there are Indian. Reporter Allison Van Diggelen went to a pre-Diwali celebration to find out how Indians have influenced the language and culture of Silicon Valley businesses.
I'm here at the Diwali Festival in Memorial Park in Cupertino. The sun is shining and the Indian diaspora is out here in force. Indian boys and girls are dancing. Vendors sell vibrant clothes and crafts. Most women are wearing saris. Some men wear embroidered kurtas or tunics. But most wear the classic garb of Silicon Valley, jeans and t-shirts. I chat with Jasho Patnik, a software engineer from Eastern India. He says Diwali is more than a festival of lights.
A festival of spreading love. Love is not specific to Indian or to American or to British or to anybody. Love is love. Light is light.
For Patnik, Diwali and other Indian traditions like meditation inform his view of technology. Take the word avatar, a Hindu concept popularized by the blockbuster movie. It pops up all over the place, in computer sciences, artificial intelligence, and even robotics. Here's Padmashree Warrior, Chief Technology and Strategy Officer at Cisco Systems in San Jose.
Avatar is actually a Sanskrit Hindi word. It's a spirit taking a new form for something. For me, every time I see that word, it instills a sense of pride.
This spiritual influence from India has become embedded in the Silicon Valley culture. Of course, words like guru and mantra have been around in America for decades. But in tech boardrooms and coffee shops, expressions like coding guru and fail fast mantra are now part of the Silicon Valley vernacular. How about this one? Jungli is a Hindi word meaning wild or ill-mannered. It was used by a Silicon Valley startup that was acquired by Amazon. And then there are the cultural differences. In the Indian culture, it's hard to say no. Instead, according to Raj Oberoi, CEO of software startup Telligen, they obfuscate, often using what he calls the bobblehead gesture.
Indians have the unique ability to move their heads, you know, from left to right, and it looks just like a bobblehead on your, you know, car dashboard.
Does it always say no?
No, it can also mean a yes, which is what's so confusing. Is that a yes? Is that a no? Is that a maybe? Or are you having some neck issues?
During India's colonial days, the English language absorbed many words from Hindi, words such as jungle, juggernaut, and pundit. These words have migrated from India to Britain to America, but some well-educated Indians in Silicon Valley still talk in a stilted English of centuries past. Raj Oberoi shares some examples.
Phrases like do the needful or, you know, I beg to stay.
This old-fashioned talk sometimes leaves American colleagues in the IT world seeking explanations.
It's a rediscovery for Americans of a language that even in England is basically dying out. You know, it's more archaic. It's very formal, it's very flowery. It harkens back to the days of the Raj.
Cisco's Padmashree Warrior shares an example of Hinglish, a Hindi-English mingling that adds Hindi suffixes to English words.
Hey, did you go to Jim Shim yesterday? That means, like, did you go to work out?
Growing up in India, Warrior describes how she was taught to conform. In Silicon Valley, her words and the way she thinks have changed.
If you close your eyes and say what words come to your mind, risk-taking, entrepreneurship, out of the box. In the Valley, we want talent that breaks the rules, creates disruptive innovation. These words have been added uniquely to my vocabulary.
What about the people at the back?
At the Diwali Festival, Joshua Patnik says Silicon Valley is a home away from home. And enlightened thought is the key to both computer programming and changing the world.
It is the way you think. That's where it starts with.
It's true, enlightenment is coming from multicultural, multilingual India. But an American version of enlightenment is also rubbing off on the Indians who now populate multicultural, multilingual Silicon Valley. For the world, I'm Allison Van Diggelen in Silicon Valley, California.
We have more stories about language in our podcast, The World in Words. To listen, just go to pri.org/language. How does an artist find her muse? How does an author get inspired? Many have rituals, but it's not easy separating the wacky from what really works. With that in mind, The Guardian's Oliver Berkman set out to test some of the daily rituals that creative geniuses have used throughout history. He was inspired by a new book, Daily Rituals, by Mason Curry.
So here are the six big lessons that I learned. Number one, be a morning person. So it's not that there are no successful night owls in the annals of famous authors and artists and others, but it's really extraordinary how many of them got up very, very early in the morning. 7 a.m. is really the latest that you find among this group of early risers and going straight into their most important creative work of the day. Ernest Hemingway, he said, at that hour, there's no one to disturb you, and it is cool or cold, and you come to your work and warm as you write. Number two, don't give up the day job. William Faulkner working at a power plant, T.S. Eliot benefiting from the structure of a day job at Lloyds Bank, William Carlos Williams, the poet, also a paediatrician who wrote poetry on the backs of his prescription pads. I think what these people get from those jobs is structure and self-discipline and also focus, because if you've only got a few hours a day to do your art, then you're really going to concentrate on doing it. Number three, take lots of walks. Tchaikovsky thought that he had to take a two-hour daily walk, and that if he returned even a few minutes early, terrible things would happen to him. So you find this recurring over and over again, not just among composers, but among all sorts of creatives who seem to find that stepping away from any kind of focused productivity is a crucial complement to the focused work. Number four, stick to a schedule. There's this idea that you have to wait for inspiration to strike. You just have to wander around spontaneously and await the muse. But what's really clear is that some of the most effective and impressive artistic creations have happened on a much more rigorous schedule. Number five, practice strategic substance abuse. So if you look back through history, almost every possible chemical that could help produce work has been tried. Ayn Rand and Graham Greene both relied on Benzedrine. There were others who chose Ritalin. But it's really caffeine that stands out as the substance to strategically abuse if you want to be producing to a schedule on a regular basis. Balzac drank 50 cups a day and died rather young of heart failure. But in a more modest way, it does seem to be ubiquitous among people who are getting art done. Number six, learn to work anywhere. Just as I don't think you should wait for inspiration and follow a schedule instead, it's clear that lots of people have found that if they learn to work anywhere, they're not going to be prey to that perfectionistic idea that they need to find the ideal workspace before they can get anything done. Agatha Christie always used to have this problem with journalists who wanted to see where she wrote, and the answer was just any stable tabletop on which she could put her typewriter was a place where she could write. So I think it needs to be said that you're not going to become an artistic genius, obviously, just by structuring your life like various other artistic geniuses did. But they are a source, these routines and rituals, of inspiration that can at least get the spark going. I'm Oliver Berkman. Good luck finding your own perfect daily routine.
Note to self, don't give up my day job. That was The Guardian's Oliver Berkman, who was himself inspired by his review of the book Daily Rituals by Mason Curry. If you'll pardon the blatant John Stewart ripoff, we'd like to provide you with a quick moment of zen. No woman, no drive. No woman, no drive. This weekend, a handful of women in Saudi Arabia defied a ban on driving and took to the wheel, many posting videos of themselves on YouTube. But what got the biggest response on social media was a video made by a Saudi comedian. No Woman, No Drive has had more than 3 million views on YouTube. Say, say, say I remember when you used to sit in the family car backseat. It's a satirical video set to the tune of Bob Marley's No Woman, No Cry, with the words changed to focus on driving. It was put together by Hisham Faghi and a Saudi production house that specializes in online comedy. Faghi won't say whether he approves or disapproves of women driving. He would only say, my philosophy is that you do something you think is funny and hope that other people enjoy it. You can find that video at our website, pri.org. So put your car key away. You're listening to The World on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com. And by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting 12 Years a Slave, the true story of a man who overcame more than a decade of injustice to reclaim his freedom, in theaters now.
I'm Aaron Schachter, and this is The World. Peru's economy is exploding, and so is the real estate market there. Housing's gotten so tight in Lima that it's even spilled over into some of the country's archaeological sites. These sites are supposed to be protected, but land traffickers have been selling fake titles. So people are building homes, even entire neighborhoods, on top of important ruins. And there's almost no one to stop them. Annie Murphy with our partners at Radio Ambulante reports on one woman who's trying to hold back the tide.
A brass band is set up at the entrance to Peru's Ministry of Culture. The building itself looks like a cross between a Soviet-era high-rise and an Inca fortress. And several stories up, in one tiny office, historian Blanca Alva is rushing through a pile of work. Alva is in her 50s. She's been deaf since childhood and communicates by reading lips. She's the main person in charge of defending Peru's cultural patrimony, and it's a pretty crazy job. A few years ago, she had to spend the holidays keeping thousands of people from moving into an archaeological site.
Cerraron la carretera, pusieron piedras y tiraban bombas molotov.
The squatters closed the highway, threw rocks, launched Molotov cocktails at us. But with the help of the police, we were able to carry out the eviction. And that was how I spent Christmas.
Alva says she's constantly running up against the limits of her job. For one thing, her team is just four people to protect about 2,100 regional sites. The Peruvian legal system doesn't help either.
The problem with Peruvian law is that you have to evict people in the first 24 hours. Once the 24 hours are up, you can't evict. You have to take it to court.
Which means that it can take years to move people, if it happens at all. Take a site called Necropolis Miramar, where people have been living for almost 10 years. It's a dry, windy plain next to a highway in the seaside district of Ancon. There are about 200 small houses clustered together and a lot of trash.
All kinds of trash here. Concrete, blocks, broken up, bricks, plastic, diapers, shoes, pair of balloon jeans, box for some pantyhose.
There are just a few small signs, and at first glance, I didn't think the place was anything special. And neither did 24-year-old Flor Gomez when she bought a plot here. The deed later turned out to be fake.
When I was told that this is Necropolis Miramar, I started to do research, and that was when I saw the maps, that all of this is part of the archaeological site.
Including the ground under the converted shed where Gomez lives with her mother. Gomez, who studies history, says she was shocked to learn she was living atop a pre-Hispanic cemetery. Meanwhile, local officials make little effort to keep more people from moving in. Jorge Arrianos is in charge of sites like Necropolis Miramar, but when I went out with him, it was his first time at the ruins, and he refused to get near Gomez or any of the homes.
First, it's a security issue. People always get defensive, since they think we want to kick them out. Culturally, we should do it. But legally, they know we don't control that area, and that we can't do it.
Lack of cooperation from local governments and police, says Blanca Alva, makes it even harder for her team.
The issue is that we're like firefighters, and we don't have the resources or the people. An archaeologist calls and says, come quickly, they're destroying an ancient wall. And it takes us 2 hours to get there. And by the time we do, it's been destroyed.
And as housing prices in Lima increase, so do takeovers of important ruins. Alva says that in the first half of this year alone, there were 71 takeovers.
The land traffickers are very enterprising. They advance every day, four or five more houses. And they know I can't be there every day.
But that doesn't stop her from trying. For Ambulante in the World, I'm Annie Murphy in Lima.
Finally today, the death of rocker Lou Reed has sent many fans back to their music collections to pull out and play their favorite Reed albums. The World's Patrick Cox is one of them. And Patrick, which is your favorite?
Well, Aaron, I've just gone the whole hog. You never listen to Lou Reed for the laughs. And maybe that is why my favorite record is perhaps the very bleakest that he made. It's called Berlin. It's from 1973. It's a song cycle that depicts the disintegration of a relationship of a man and a woman. And I think what made me listen up when I first heard it was that it dealt with issues that, well, you don't really hear these issues in rock or pop music. Things like domestic abuse, drug addiction, child neglect. This record is beyond harrowing, but it's also quite beautiful.
Caroline says, as she makes up her eye, you ought to learn more about yourself. Think more than just I. But she's not afraid to die. All of her friends call her Alaska. When she takes speed, they laugh and ask her what is in her mind.
Patrick, why is the album entitled Berlin?
Well, the album is set in Berlin. The couple is supposed to live there. And this is the odd thing. I heard Berlin sometime in the 1980s. It was right after the second trip that I had made to Berlin and West Berlin. The Wall was there at the time. It was this edgy, tightly wound place, seedy, bohemian. And I thought, when I heard the record, that Lou Reed had perfectly caught the spirit of the city. And then sometime later, I read that he'd never been to Berlin. He only went for the first time a couple of years after he recorded the album. He was using this foreign city, this notoriously split city, as a metaphor for the relationship of these two people he was writing about. And when I've listened to the album, you know, more recently, it makes even more sense to know that, you know, Lou Reed, very much the New Yorker, very much the poet, was using other parts of the world like Berlin metaphorically rather than literally.
Lou Reed, the consummate New Yorker. Patrick Cox, thank you.
You're welcome, Aaron.
We end our program with another Lou Reed composition, Street Hassle, recorded a few years after Berlin. That's all for us today from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios in Boston. I'm Aaron Schachter, and we'll be back tomorrow.
World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI and WGBH, supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, ArtWorks, by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues, by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems, at skoll.org, the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund, and by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include John and Caroline Ballantyne, Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, and Michael and Anne Cerisi.
PRI, Public Radio International.